This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and I'm joined as always by Bradley Chambers. Tonight we have one sponsor for the show, and that's the fine folks at Jamf Software, makers of Jamf Pro and Jamf Now MDM solutions for iOS, Mac, and other Apple TV-like devices. We'll tell you more about them as the show goes on. Bradley, how are you?
We're back together, first time in many weeks.
Back together, yeah.
Yeah, so I had a couple of follow-up notes from my show at ISTE. I had a lot of kind words sent to me. Thanks for everybody for that. And so I had some additional kind of questions DM'd me and emailed me about dual 5 gigahertz and how that relates to schools and existing deployments and things like that, and like ways you can augment that. So I'll probably cover that in depth on a future show because it even if you're not doing like a new deployment this summer, it's certainly something you can go in there and I guess particularly if you have Aerohive, you can go in there and kind of swap out an AP and put it into a 5 gigahertz. So it's nothing you've got to do deployment wide. Like, you can have like a handful of places be dual 5 gigahertz. We'll cover that more in another show in the future. But thanks for everybody for the kind words. It was a fun show to do. It's always fun to be on location. ISTE was it's a lot of fun. It's busy as always. San Antonio was great. I got to run along the Riverwalk there. So if anybody's been there, you'll know what I'm talking about. It's just a really fun city. It's always kind of crazy. And every time I've been there for ISTE, the last time someone like, well, not San Antonio, but ISTE specifically, it's like last year I was there and I don't even remember what city it was in. I'm trying to think. Denver. It's in Denver. Somebody got like shot two buildings over. Well, this year, like one of the big hotels caught on fire, and like I was going to lunch with a friend from our favorite fruit company, and like we ended up having to take this like very convoluted walk to a lunch that should have been one block away because of so many fire trucks on the road. So, kind of crazy times, but a good week as always. My big takeaway from just watching the exhibit floor is there's a big emphasis on coding and then also like doing not augmented reality, but basically like doing things in iPad apps that then make physical things move. I don't even know what the technical term for that is, but like building those kind of solutions.
Yeah, because the thing is people can't sell you something unless it's a physical product, right? I mean, that's kind of one of the things. I had a friend who is really heavily into using Sphero in the classroom, Sphero robot, and he was like, well, you should get some for your school and stuff like that. And I was like, yeah, but the thing is when I'm teaching in Swift playgrounds, everybody's got their own Swift playground to work in, whereas if I get like two robots for the class, I'm back to two computers for everybody, and that's the thing that makes that quite difficult. That kind of physical computing stuff is that you end up like your class has to go through a bottleneck again of just like, I've only got two Spheros, so only some people can be on it at one time. Whereas when you're doing things in software and you're one-to-one, everybody can do it all at once and everybody can have their own. So that's a tricky balancing act, because you could end up sort of taking your school back to not being one-to-one anymore, even if you've got one-to-one computers. But if your class kind of runs through these devices and you only get a few of them, that can be possibly quite tricky.
Yeah, and those things typically are not cheap. Those kind of devices, they are typically not cheap. So that seems to be the trend. But yeah, I mean, that just again because people can't sell you. There's only so many devices they can sell you, and so they now are having to sell you things that you do with the devices.
Yeah, because the actual hardware market is locked up between iPad and Chromebook, and suppose some Windows laptops as well, but. Nobody's breaking into that, right? The Amplify tablet never went anywhere, and no other tablet has gone anywhere, so you've got to add, the business now is basically selling accessories for iPads and Chromebooks, and I think that's one of the big areas where it's going, because that's an expensive accessory, right? It's not like a bag or a screen cover or a pencil case holder or something like that. It's a $300 accessory or $400 accessory in some cases as well.
Yeah, and then again, you talk about spending even $200 extra per device for an entire classroom set of something. That's a lot of money.
It sure is, and essentially nobody's going to do that. So you have to just be careful not to sort of revert or regress back from one-to-one by virtue of bringing in these additional products into the classroom as well.
So yeah, good show. We'll have some more follow-up on dual 5 gigahertz in the future.
Cool. Big Apple presence at ISTE this year.
There was. They had a little booth kind of outside the exhibit hall, but then they had what's the place? How do I explain that? Just almost like a big room where they're doing like not demos, but they were just like helping you do things, and they had a lot of sessions. I mean, and they were booked up,
lab situation.
Yeah, it was labs, and yeah. I mean, they were all sold out immediately, pretty much on the day of. And so a friend of mine that I had lunch with, he was talking about how like exhausted they were and how busy it was, and how just, like the Wi-Fi was kind of difficult because the problem with those kind of shows is like outside the exhibit hall, the Wi-Fi was fine. But like you go in the exhibit hall and I screenshotted it. There were 7 iPhone 7 Plus pages of SSIDs. And that just is not workable for anybody.
No.
There's even on 5 gigahertz, you start running into issues there. And so everybody, it would be nice if there was like a way to do that where there was just one. But then a lot of those aren't really even like active internet connections. It's like basically these little ad hoc networks that Boost have built to make their things work.
Yeah, I mean, it's all these connected devices to iPads and have just thrown up their hotspot just to make it work.
Right, and it was just, so yeah, you go like he was kind of complaining about that, and you go out, you go in the lobby and it's fine. You walk in there, and I don't have good cell phone service in there either, so it's like a kind of a dead zone. But that was Apple's first time they had been there and that big of a presence since I had gone.
Yeah, no, I don't remember them being as big there either.
So yeah, good show. Hopefully I'll be back next year, but it is definitely a good show.
So I thought, Bradley, what we'd maybe talk about this week is kind of in line with, you know, the biggest thing that happens in the summer that's not a redeployment, which is getting ready for the next version of iOS. And this was kind of inspired by a post that friend of the show Tom Bridge made last year. There actually was a presentation at the Mac DMV and also a blog post that went along with it. And we'll put a link to both the video and the blog post in the show notes because it's still available. He was talking then about iOS 10 and getting ready for iOS 10 and Sierra and just looking at the kind of things you might want to do as preparation for the release and knowing what kind of things you're facing, trying to figure out what the problems might be and trying to get them reported and fixed before the final release. So I thought we'd maybe take a wee dive into that this week, Bradley, and just kind of, because I've developed more this year than I have in previous years in terms of what I'm doing for testing with iOS 11 and just making sure that it's going to meet our needs. And I thought it might be worth just kind of talking about that, sharing with everybody.
Absolutely.
Cool. So, Bradley, let me ask you this question. Right? Why is this important to start with?
Well, I mean, depending on, number one, like if you make your living managing these things, if there are showstoppers, in terms of things that are broken, they typically won't be the type of problems that everybody will run across. So like everybody won't be doing the kind of deployment things that you and I and our listeners do. So it's like somebody's got to test that stuff every release, and you don't want to run into something that like is just fundamentally broken, and then you don't really find out about it until October.
I mean, I think that's one of the things particularly with kind of education. Very centralized, well-managed education deployments. There's not that many people doing that. You know, lots of schools have got iPads, but not everybody's doing it the kind of way that we talk about on this show. So it may well be that we are one of a few, you know, 100 schools maybe, who are doing the sort of full-stack Apple deployment, maybe a bit more. And it's not necessarily likely that everybody's going to have the same combination of settings that you have. And maybe there's a bug where if you have this restriction on and that restriction on, then something doesn't work correctly. Do you know what I mean? So there's all this kind of feature interaction stuff that you might be the only school in the world that uses this combination of settings, and there's a bug that affects that particular combination. But because of the kind of release cadence of iOS, you know, it comes out in October, WWDC next year is the next one. This release is going to define your whole school year. There's not going to be another release. There's going to be bug fixes, of course, and updates, but there's not going to be a different iOS for next year. iOS 11 is the iOS for 2017-18 school year. And at the end of the day, Bradley, I think the other thing is that you can't stop people updating. So on the first day iOS 11 comes out, you will have somebody in your organization who presses that button on day one, and you need to be ready for what's going to happen when that does happen. So for me, that's some of the reasons why it's important to kind of look at what you're going to do here. And that's why I've been kind of inspired to get more ready for it this year than I have in previous years as well.
Well, and I was thinking about, this is something obviously you can't test, but I was thinking about High Sierra and how that relates to our teachers. And it kind of hit me on the way out, like APFS is a thing on the Mac. And it seems like on iOS, it just kind of did it, and it just happened. But on the Mac, you have, I mean, at least now, you have the option to migrate or not migrate. Teachers will have to know how to deal with that. And B, it just feels like something that is like, upgrading OSs is one thing, but upgrading the OSs in the file system is a whole other thing.
And do you have in place a process for, first of all, deciding whether you're going to recommend that people turn that switch on or not? And then secondly, how are you going to help them do that? And do you need to make sure you've got like extra backups in place or something like that as well? These are all some of the concerns on the Mac side with High Sierra. And of course, in iOS, we're probably already over that hump, but is everybody over that hump? I mean, that's one of the things I've been working on over the past little while, is trying to get everybody up to at least 10.3 so that we've done the APFS migration before we do the iOS 11 migration, and getting everything over that line is, I feel, is quite important as well at that point.
Yeah, I'm almost like happy that we got through APFS like last year, and kind of wasn't really that big of a deal. And it's like one less thing to worry about with iOS 11.
Yeah, transitioning both of those things at once might be quite nerve-wracking. But I mean, to be Apple's credit, iOS APFS migration worked perfect. Seems to have worked perfectly worldwide, and that's no small achievement when you're talking about the scale that they're doing that at as well.
So, how long I was thinking, like, you know, I love right now getting these new betas, especially particularly like with beta 3 for the developers and public beta 2. That's when I feel like things do start stabilizing, like where you could run it and outside of your battery life, things are going to be horribly broken for standard apps. Obviously, there's still some third-party apps that don't work perfectly. But for you with this testing workflow, that almost has to mean like, okay, it's another day's work. Like how long does it take you to get through your testing workflow?
Well, suffice to say, I didn't get through it on beta 2 at all. that was mainly because I was traveling for most of the life of beta 2, and I didn't actually have a good enough internet connection to test all the things I wanted to test, because it involves quite a lot of kind of back and forth work with our device management server. So I would say probably from start to finish, I could do it in maybe an afternoon. There's some things that are slow about it. We'll talk in some detail about what is in my sort of list of things that I test, but in there involves things like erasing the device, reinstalling the device a couple of times, reverting the device back to iOS 10 and doing an upgrade test and things like that as well. So you're talking about a little bit of time in between times. So it's important to set aside enough time. And I find that I've got better results if I do it all in one go rather than doing a bit one day, a bit the next day. You sort of forget the results of what you did the day before and things like that. So that's kind of how I would do it. And that's about the kind of time it takes me at the moment.
Well, you know, the next step is for you to build a workflow to do all this for you.
Yeah, well, I was actually speculating about that on Twitter earlier on, just thinking, well, maybe not workflow, but certainly the GSS has a Python API, or it has a REST API that you can call with Python. And I was wondering, you know, what would it take to kind of encode this testing workflow as a set of scripts that would at least just make the GSS do something like, I don't know, maybe I've got some testing profiles and I just, you know, run a script to scope one onto the device I'm working with and see how it goes. Maybe that's not too difficult. Maybe something I'll work on over the next little while. Because the reason for doing that would mainly be that you don't forget things, or you don't miss things out, or you don't do it wrong. Consistency is kind of important in this as well, to make sure you're getting the same results and you're testing the same things from build to build. So maybe I'll take a look at that as well.
Okay, so let's talk about like what all kind of things you should test in your, when you're testing workflow, if you want to go down this path.
Yeah, so I think really the way I came to put together my list of things that I'm going to test is basically just to look at, well, what matters to me, right? I don't really care that much whether or not, I don't know, we don't use VPN, for example, right? We don't use Microsoft Exchange. Now, whenever you're testing stuff, Apple are always got a lot of stuff in their notes about Microsoft Exchange and things, but I don't use it, so I don't really care whether Exchange support is broken or not, because it's not going to affect me. Maybe from an altruistic point of view, I should do something about it, but I really only have time to test the things that matter to me, so I very much kind of restrict my list of things I'm going to test to basically things that will make my life a nightmare if they're not working when iOS 11 comes out. So in particular, one of the first things that I would test, Bradley, is the new operating system functions. So whatever's the new features in the OS, those are the things I'm going to test. Now, not so much the deep functionality of, say, notes or drag and drop or something like that, but I'm going to look at things like there's new stuff in iOS 11 to do with like automatic setup. So you can set up a new device from an old device. Does that work? There's a thing where you can, if you get two iOS 11 devices nearby, they can, if you've got a friend comes over and you can give them your Wi-Fi password by putting their device near your device, and your device will be prompted to provide them with the Wi-Fi key. So stuff like that, I'm looking at that going, okay, well, first of all, does it work? And secondly, I'm asking myself the question, what is the impact of that for me? Like, if I have got kids who've, you know, say I'm a school who's got a pre-shared key for the Wi-Fi, then do I want it to be the case that anybody who brings a device near your school device can get a copy of the Wi-Fi key? I don't think so. So I'm looking at maybe, do I need new controls in there as well? Because that's something to feedback as well. If there's like a feature that's missing, you might want to feed that back too.
Yeah, that is a that feature is a concern of mine in our world. I mean, obviously for the home, that's one thing, but I mean, again, I can even see it even like in pre-shared key why you wouldn't want that, or even in private pre-shared key why you wouldn't want that.
Yeah, because my private pre-shared key is limited to one device. So if it's shared, if that key gets shared between two or three devices, that's more of a problem for me. And as far as I can see, there's not a control for that. You can't stop that from happening. Unless maybe managed Apple IDs or something like that don't let you do it.
Yeah, that'll be something that, I can't imagine that wouldn't have been something that the engineers would have thought about. Like, what if there are... Even, and obviously, we have our concerns, but you can imagine like big businesses. That, you know, it's even more.
I don't know. I can't find at the moment a limitation on that feature, but we'll see. Maybe they'll add it in a new beta.
Well, and that's easily something that could come. One of the things, if you've got as you're testing your devices and you're taking them from like out of the box, is look at what, you know, the setup, the new assistant like setup panels that you work through, like how are those, you know, with your setup, do those work? Does it trigger something? Does it miss something? Does that process work? Because every school is going to have a different kind of workflow on what they, if they want students to work through each one of those, if they want to kind of pre-schedule them. That's something that kind of, I think that was fairly new in iOS 10.3, where you can really bypass a lot of those things. So that's definitely something to check out.
Yeah, because with every release, there's often a new setup assistant panel, and you want to make sure that, for example, your setup workflow, if you've chosen to skip some of those settings, that they're still being skipped, and also that if there are new ones that you might want to add to your set of things you want to skip, you want to know about that as well. But just a little suggestion there, Bradley, as well. When it comes to deployment, don't always just test on a brand new installation of iOS 11, because back in, I think it was iOS 8, right, from the transition from 7 to 8, there was a bug in a very, very early version of iOS 8, I think it might have been 8.0, where if you had a supervised device that updated over the air, it would lose its supervision profile, which of course has got quite serious consequences for management, and also it was difficult to get it back as well. So it's quite important to, you can use the Apple Configurator to do this, like put your test device back down to iOS 10, set it up, and then roll up to iOS 11 and make sure that everything's still there. All the apps that you expect, the behavior is still connected to your MDM, check that it's still supervised, all that kind of stuff. Don't always just install fresh iOS 11 and test it from there. Go back to the current release and test the upgrade process as well. That's really important.
Yeah, that's a great idea, because things happen, you know, new devices versus devices coming on. Obviously, they have, you know, different set of apps installed. It is a different workflow.
Yeah, and you've got things like there's a password in place. Is the password still preserved? All that kind of stuff. And the next thing that kind of goes along with that, Bradley, is then this is the big bit of work, really, is testing your configuration profile restrictions, making sure that when you restrict something, it actually gets restricted on the device. And in my testing matrix, this is the longest part, because I look at all the configuration profiles we have, and it's quite easy because we have a rule for like one restriction per profile on our settings. So I can just look at all the things I've got, and I can basically make a list of, does this profile work? Does this profile work? Does this profile work? And so on. But what you need to do there is you put the profile on, and then you have to manually go on the device and make sure that it's not possible to do the thing that's been restricted. So just as an example, in iOS 11 Beta 1, we use a restriction that prevents the students from configuring the parental restrictions on the device. And we found that in beta 1 there was a bug, which is fixed already, where if that restriction was applied, it was applied but it wasn't being honored by settings. So you could actually go into the restrictions and you could go ahead and turn on the restrictions even though the profile said that it was not there. So I found a couple of things like that and I reported them all and they were all fixed pretty quickly in the next version. So that's the kind of benefit, right? Imagine, you know, that had slipped through and some kid discovered it with iOS 11.0. You've got a problem in your hands at that stage. So looking at things like that, configuration profile restrictions, also testing whatever else you land with a profile, such as calendar. We use a calendar subscription. We use the Google account payload to put a Google account on the device. What other kind of things? The home screen lock message, we do that as well. Requiring a passcode. All those kind of things are important to just make sure that although you've landed the profile, is the operating system actually honoring the profile restriction, yes or no? And that's worth having a wee check of as well.
Yeah, I mean, these are the kind of things you want to know these things now, certainly.
Yeah.
All right, so next thing definitely test out is adding and removing apps, both of them. Obviously, both of them should be working fine. Again, installing apps from the App Store is slightly different than installing apps from your MDM.
Yeah, and you want to make sure that whatever set of restrictions you've got in place is doing the right thing, basically. Now, cool feature in iOS 11 is that, in principle, it should be possible to silently install an app on a locked device. Now, if you've been administering iOS 10 and earlier, you'll know that the device has to be unlocked before the device will start to install apps or app updates that are prompted by your MDM server. In iOS 11, that's supposed to no longer be true. So that's another example of like testing something that is new and making sure it does what you expect as well.
Yes. Installing on locked devices will be nice, especially if you get when you're trying to get something. Let's say kids are you got a set of kids that are, I don't know, like out at recess, and you want to, and they're all, their iPads are inside, and you want to push out a big app that's going to take a little bit, but they're all locked. You don't want it to have to wait till they wake up to grab that app.
Next thing as well is what I'm sort of describing as MDM commands. So what I mean by that is the kind of commands that you push from your MDM to a device, such as requesting that it updates the inventory, setting the device name, turning on lost mode. We're actually leaning on lost mode a lot more these days. I don't know if you're using that a lot, Bradley, but I've found 3 or 4 devices this year using MDM-powered lost mode, and it's been really helpful. Shut down and restart, things like that. And also this is where the time-consuming part comes in as well, testing remote wipe. I know it's tedious and you've got to set up the device again. So this tends to be the last thing I test once I've been through everything else. Let's just make sure we can wipe it as well, because that's important from your sort of information security point of view, maybe more for staff devices than student, but also for student too, that if you do lose a device that you can remotely kill it from afar. So that's something worth checking too.
Yes. Okay. Network behavior. Obviously, how your iPad interacts with your Wi-Fi network is big. So check and see how it roams. Again, client devices control roaming. This is, you can lead the devices in a certain way based on how your Wi-Fi is designed, but ultimately the clients control how they roam. And then check things like, is AirPrint working and how is AirPlay mirroring working? And this might even be a time you want to update an Apple TV to the beta of TV OS 11. And you would need like a USB-C cable to do that, but it's fairly simple.
Yeah. No, definitely. If you have an Apple TV over the summer holidays, put a couple of them on iOS 11 or TV OS 11 beta and make sure that pairing is working as well. But you also want to keep some in the old version, because you're not necessarily going to always encounter a fully up-to-date Apple TV. So if there is a version problem, you might want to be aware of that as well.
All right. So what is next on our list?
Yeah, the last thing I've got in my list is the behavior of key apps, right? So one of the ways I look at this is I ask myself, well, what are the 5 apps that the school could not run a day without in our world? And for us, that would probably be something like Pages, Keynote, Safari, Notability, and iTunes U. Right? If any of those 5 apps have a serious problem, we're going to have a serious problem sort of getting through our work on a daily basis. So those are 5 apps that I'm going to just, perhaps less formally at the moment, just have a look at, you know, are they working okay? Are they stable? Are there things that crash? Are there any data loss problems? And hopefully there won't be. You know, those are all kind of high-end, well-designed applications. And as far as I've seen so far in my sort of general use of them, they seem okay in iOS 11. But just, you know, that would be a question I would be asking. If I was a business, I would say, well, what are key line of business applications? Let's test them in iOS 11 as well. And the other thing I would do is if there are any apps that I'm suspicious of, right, any apps that seem to, you know, are not that stable at the best of times, making sure that iOS 11 hasn't sort of finally broken any of them as well.
Well, and this is, you know, there may be some schools that run into apps that are not going to work on iOS 11 due to 32 bits. And they've been giving you a warning for a year about it needs to be optimized. But, you know, I tell you, it'd be nice if there'd be a way for like your MDM to maybe send you like a daily or weekly email of the apps in your catalog that have been updated and like with the release notes.
Yeah, it would be nice if there was some way to kind of audit your app catalog for 32-bitness or 64-bitness or whatever. I don't think there is, because your MDM doesn't actually have the binary. It only has the sort of App Store record, doesn't it? So it's, unless the App Store is reporting that information, which I don't know that it does, I don't know if you could do that.
Yeah, that seems like that's a high-hanging fruit for deployments. Yeah, that would be like, I don't know. Yeah, there's a lot of things there's a lot of things where you might want to catalog information, like, you know, when's the last time this app was updated? What's the current price of it? Just things like that.
So, yeah, I suppose the next question is, like, what can you not test?
Obviously, anything that's reliant on, like, cloud functions from Apple. And then again, your like third-party apps that you don't have updates for. So if you're wanting to test like how G Suite is going to work with the Files app, it's functional right now. It's not like it doesn't work, but I'm assuming this is not the native integration and how it's going to be, because right now, like iCloud Drive has a more native access than any of the other file apps like Dropbox or G Suite. Like, again, you can like kind of work inside of those, but I imagine there's something more deeper coming. Is that your understanding?
Yes, it is. I mean, what you're seeing at the moment in iOS 11 beta is basically you can access other document providers and you can import their files into iCloud Drive, basically. But you are not able to like move files back into these other cloud providers yet. Everybody needs to do some update work to work with files. And it's increasingly clear to me that it's going to be a real problem if, say, Dropbox, for example, doesn't update their system to work properly in the Files app or Google Drive or whoever. And I can't imagine that anybody won't do that, because, you know, that would be crazy. It'd be, you know, suicidal for your brand not to appear inside the Files app in iOS 11. But at the moment, you're living in a world where that's not possible. And the reason is because when an iOS beta is coming out or is in test, developers are not allowed to submit versions of their apps that are built against that version of the operating system, right? So there's new code in iOS 11, basically, that makes your storage provider app work with the Files app. But at the moment, unless you're on like a test version, Google or Dropbox or whoever are not allowed to release a version that fully works with iOS 11 until iOS 11 is fully out. So that's where it can get kind of tricky. Like, they can work around bugs, yeah, or changes, but they're not allowed to adopt new features until the OS is final. So you're not going to see that until the day comes. And that's still a wee tricky business. How do you get people ready for a world that might not be ready for them, if that makes sense? Like, you know, you've got, maybe with my school, for example, we're big into Google Drive. But if on day one, Google Drive is not well integrated into the Files app, how do I kind of position that for people? I don't know. So maybe we have to wait a little while and see how long it takes people to update for Files, for example.
Well, I'm on the test light for Dropbox, and they haven't added support for it yet. So, it's funny. The Files app, to me, could potentially be like, you know, like years from now, the retrospective of the biggest change in this version of iPad and what it does for our workflows. I'll tell you, A good idea for a podcast or a blog that someone can steal is called Save to Files. So savetofiles.com, that's probably not available. But I do that so much now on my iPad and on my iPhone. I've kind of pulled all of my documents out of Dropbox and thrown them into iCloud Drive. I still have like a pictures backup in Dropbox because I'm also testing iCloud Photos for iOS 11 as well. But I'll tell you, I am still... I could probably never go all in on iCloud Drive because we use G Suite so much at our work. It's almost like iCloud Drive is my place for my stuff, and everything that's collaboration is in G Suite. One of the things I actually did was upgraded my family to the 2 terabyte plan because now that it's only $10 a month, I mean, that's for a $10 a month storage account, that's the best value out there outside of our G Suites that are free. And I think even if you don't have a education edition, even getting unlimited storage through G Suite isn't even maybe close to that, or maybe like $15 a month. But because I'm on iOS 11, I was able to go ahead and do the family sharing. And so my whole family now shares 2 terabytes, even the people that aren't on iOS 11. And I've got a blog post about that I'll have a link to. And one caveat on the family sharing is it does not work on the 99 cents plan. So if you're the type of family that just literally needs about 10 gigs a person, you cannot share that plan. It's only on the $2.99 and up plan that you can share. So the $2.99 is 50 gigs, and then the $9.99 is 2 terabytes. So 2 terabytes for $10 a month shared amongst your family is an incredible, incredible value.
Yeah, because I'm looking at bringing, you know, April and Beth, who are a bit older. They've had Apple IDs since before Apple IDs for children and family sharing was possible. So I'm looking at, should I bring them into family sharing? My question, right, is whether or not I can, because they have like essentially adult Apple IDs, can I make it so that they have to ask for permission to buy? Because if I can't, then I don't know if I can bring them in. But I think that might have changed since I first looked at family sharing, where if you bring in a member, you can turn on request to buy for them. That's my reading of the documentation anyway. I don't know if it's right.
Well, I mean, the crazy thing is, like, you and I both have the same number of kids in our family. So we've got 2 adults, 3 children. That's 5 people. So for $10 a month, I can share 2 terabytes. And then for $15 more a month, we get all the music in the world. So I'm paying $25 a month essentially to Apple. And I'm getting, honestly, an incredible value of services back.
We're seriously thinking about an Apple Music family plan. At the moment, I got one of those $100 vouchers where you get a year's Apple Music. So that'll run until December. But come December, I'm going to seriously be looking at the possibility of going onto a family plan.
Oh, the family plan is the way to go. Yeah. Even if it's just for 2 people, it works out cheaper. And where it's nice is, so it gives you up to 6 streams. So it's obviously like 6, you know, the idea is 6 family members. But where this is nice is, like, right now, obviously on Apple TV, there's not a way to kind of like have different identities in the Apple TV. Like you have an app, you know, if you're signed into Apple Music on your Apple TV, like it's your stuff. Well, like on yours right now, if you're listening on your iPhone and your wife goes to listen to something on Apple TV, it stops your iPhone and vice versa. Well, if you have the family plan, you can both listen, even though that it's your library.
It's the extra stream. Yeah,
it gives you the extra stream. So the family plan is, gosh, I mean, you break it down like per person in the family. Like, that's a great deal.
Yep. Yeah, it sure is.
Yeah. Now, so that got me thinking, and I think we kind of covered this last show. I'm really starting to think that Apple's solution for iCloud storage is going to be OneDrive and G Suite in the Files app.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. It seems very clear to me, because the thing about the Files app that's not obvious right now because the apps aren't updated is that, like, that interface is intended to replace the file picker in, like, Pages and Keynote, right? So when you open Keynote, you see all your Keynote files in that kind of grid of icons. The Files interface is what's going to replace that, right? So you're going to open Keynote. The first thing you're going to see is a view of your iCloud Drive, and you're going to pick Keynote files from there. So if you imagine that you're all in on G Suite, then you could, you know, just have your kids turn on G Suite. The first thing you see when you open up Keynote, I suppose, is going to be your G Suite, your G Drive folder. So it seems to me that you're essentially going to get a first-class user experience with G Suite and, like, iWork apps, for example, which is something that I never kind of thought I would see before, and it's certainly not the case now. But you could actually live your whole life on Google Drive and still get a first-class experience inside Keynote and Pages, which is quite an interesting idea.
Yeah, I mean, it's getting outside of, like, again, it doesn't solve, like, things like extra backup space and all that, but theoretically, you shouldn't need a very big backup outside of maybe media and pictures if most of your files are in, you know, OneDrive.
Yeah, except the problem is it's the photos that kill you all the time, right? You know, everybody's got like 2 megs of Pages documents, you know, and 5 to 8 gigabytes of photos. It's the media that kills you. So I don't know if maybe the answer is going to be to like get a much more aggressive Google Photos plan for the school or something like that. I don't know. But the problem with Google Photos, I think, is integration, right? Because a lot of the time we take photographs and videos because we want to use them inside a Pages document, a Keynote presentation, iMovie or whatever. And if you're regularly, you know, backing up to Google Photos and then blowing away your camera roll, you're going to have to bring them back in if you want to use them again. And that's going to be a sort of extra step plus additional bandwidth. So I don't know. It's not an obvious win right now.
Yeah, and I've been testing iCloud Photos again, and it's really nice. Like the thing I can't figure out, and then I can't find anybody else that can too, is like how the files are stored on your Mac. So like when I go to my iCloud Photo library, right click on the database, it says, you know, 220 gigabytes. I right click on it, go to open, show contents. I can see folders that are that big, but I can never find the files where it's like these are the raw files, and then I. Show hidden files, can't find them. So that's the only thing to me that's kind of weird about it. But the native integration is nice. I mean, that has been nice when I go to share something on there. Like I have all my pictures there. Now that can sometimes be a negative because the camera picker can be a little bit slower, or maybe it's harder to find a document. But I went through and made albums and made folders for albums, and like it was all really nice. The memories function is really nice. In some ways, it's better than what's on Google Photos, particularly because it makes those move. Like where Google Photos, like just as oh, in this day a year ago, it shows you that. Where Apple TV does it in a way, like it'll make memories. It showed us, like, you know, we've gone to the same place for vacation for many years. Like it made a movie of all of our vacations and kind of mashed them up together. And then it had those on the Apple TV that we could watch. It was a nice feature. So again, the biggest problem currently I'm still seeing with iCloud Photos is there's no family sharing option. And I had a blog post that I did about that a few weeks ago, trying to detail ways that could work, because I know everybody's needs would be different. Like I would probably want like my wife and I just to have the same, a unified library, just one library. But I can see where like a lot of people wouldn't want that. My wife does take pictures of random stuff. I take pictures of random stuff that end up on your camera roll. So maybe like it's in some ways you could almost say like anything my wife takes that has these people in it, like somehow sync the faces data across your accounts, like add that to my library.
Yeah, that would make sense. You know, you've got, because that's probably what you're looking for in large part. Or maybe it's, you know, only after like 15 days of not deleting that picture or something like that. Maybe that's another way to think about it. The pictures that you don't go through and clear out, maybe they're ones worth keeping, something like that as well.
Yeah, something like a grab album or something, where it's like, you know, Leah's most recent photos, and like you have to click those, or excuse me, her most recent media, and add those to your library. And you have, again, 15 days to do that. Yeah. And then, yeah, that's an option.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of ways you could cut that, I think. But I think it's probably the case that there are so many different sets of needs that it's hard to come down to like one particular rule of thumb or heuristic that would take you to what most people need.
True.
Tricky business. Yeah.
Honestly, and then the simple solution would be to allow people to sign into different iCloud Photo Libraries accounts than they do their iCloud account. That'd be a simple solution. Because that's Google gives you that option. You can just sign into a different account on the device for that app. But before we move on, let's thank our sponsor for the night. Jamth Pro is the solution for deploying, managing, and securing Apple devices. Over 3 million students are empowered by Jamth every day. Bring learning to a whole new level for your students by providing the tools they need to be successful in today's classrooms. Start a free trial at jamth.com. That's JAMF.com. So, where are we at?
We are thinking about how to test.
Obviously, like, you know, what we've described here is a list of things for you to do. That's mm-hmm. that's the first thing, is to develop that checklist.
Yep. And then you got to think about what happens when you sit down at a device, sit down at your MDM server, and what are you going to do to run through this set of tests? Now, at the moment, there isn't really an automated way to do this. But I think, I mean, we'll put a link in show notes. My testing matrix is available. It's a public Google Doc. But I think really what you should do is you should first of all write down the things that you care about. Like, look at the list of things and say, well, we only, you know, maybe you're a BYOD school, or you're maybe only dealing with staff devices or whatever. What are the things that matter to your school? And then spend your time testing the things that matter to you, because you simply do not have the time, or probably the knowledge, and I certainly don't, to test every single thing that's new. Like I mentioned, things like VPN and Exchange and stuff like that. I don't care about any of that, and I'm not going to test it because it doesn't affect me if it's broken. So be careful to only do the things that you care about. If the steps are complex, consider writing down a procedure for the test. And particularly if you find that you maybe have made a mistake with the testing at one point, maybe create some notes for how you're going to do that test next time. But basically do whatever is necessary to ensure that you can do a consistent test across we might be looking at 10 betas, right? And you want to make sure that you're testing in the same way for each one. And that's step number one, is make sure your checklist is relevant to you, because that'll keep you doing it as well. And then make sure it's repeatable. Second thing is, when you do a test, record the date and time that you do the test and the build number that you tested as well, because we're not always in the same world here. Like sometimes at the moment we're on developer beta 3, and that's the same or similar to public beta 2. I say same or similar to because it's only the build number in settings that actually guarantees it's the same version that you're talking about. And I'm not sure they are always necessarily the same version. So always record the build number that you're testing against. And then apply your settings, run your tests, do whatever you want to do, and then decide whether or not you've got a problem. So the happy situation is that you find there's no problem, that your restriction is applied and on correctly, your apps get installed correctly, all that kind of stuff. But if you encounter a problem, you got to decide what you're going to do at that point. And I suppose the first question I ask myself is this a total failure, or is it some kind of partial failure? And it's possible for you to have partial failures. So things like, what did I have one time? I had one partial failure in beta 1, which I think was something to do with the device reporting back to the NDM. I can't remember exactly what it was, but it mostly worked, but one thing seemed a bit weird or something like that. Oh yeah, it was setting the home screen, right? So the home screen, you can set whitelisted and blacklisted applications, and I was testing our exam configuration, which was whitelist only one application and blacklist everything else. And I discovered that if you whitelist one app, then everything will be hidden. But if an app has been offloaded, it will not be hidden, right? So it looks like here's the one app I want to use for the test, and then here's like five apps that have been offloaded, but they're still showing up and I can't hide them as well. So that was something where it mostly works, but there's a kind of weird extra behavior that I want to record and report on as well. So that's the kind of situation where you're going to write down what are the circumstances under which you get a partial failure. It's not just outright doesn't work, but there's maybe some additional information that needs to be captured there as well. Does that make sense?
Oh, it totally makes sense. And I had not thought about that, offload apps and how that would affect profiles. I think about that. That's a little tricky.
App offloading is an interesting one. I think we're going to have to keep a wee eye on that from an admin point of view, because I'm also a wee bit concerned that, because app offloading is supposed to be, if an app hasn't been used for a while and it's quite large, and your device is under storage pressure, that app is going to be deleted. But not deleted, it's going to be offloaded so that it can be reinstalled from the store. But, you know, what's the biggest app we use in school that doesn't get used all the time? GarageBand, right? It's like 1.6 gigs to reinstall. So it's going to be interesting. I think do we need a control for that?
How would you even be able to reinstall it is my question. Because if the app store is disabled on the device, for example, like, you know, let's say every app has to come from the MDM and the app store is disabled, that's how you would trigger the reinstall. So clearly there's got to be some sort of mechanism.
Okay, so I've got an answer to that, if I can just dive in on that, because one of your assumptions is not right there, which is that it's offloading is not the same as like deleting pre-installed apps, right? You know how you can go and delete the Tips application, and then as you say, you have to go into the App Store to reinstall it. An offloaded app doesn't actually disappear from the home screen. That's where it's different, right? So the icon remains, but beside, you know where you get the little test light indicator, the little blue indicator for an update or the yellow for a test light? In that space, there's a little the little cloud download icon with the cloud and the downward arrow. The icon is still there, and the data file is still there. The app sandbox is still there, but it's just the binary that's not there anymore. So what you do is you just tap on the app, and it just reinstalls itself. So that's the user experience part. So, but there might be some confusion about that, and I'm a wee bit worried that, you know, a teacher will say, right, you know, it's the end of the week, let's launch GarageBand. And everybody goes to GarageBand and it's been offloaded, and you've got to wait for 30 devices to reinstall a 2 gig application. That's the user experience part. I don't know. You know, maybe we need to keep an eye on that as well.
Yes. Last thing when it comes to testing is, what do you do when you find issues, particularly with third-party developers? I contact them, email them. Like, the apps that are your core apps, if they're not made by some major corporation, like, it's always good to get to know those developers. Like, say, hey, we have like 300 devices using this. Like, I'd love to be on test flight builds if you ever have any questions about how we're using it. Or, like, but again, A, be nice. Like, they can work around some bugs with current releases, but they can't totally implement new features. So, again, be nice, you know, document as much as possible. And I always try to caveat, I know this is, I'm running a pre-release, and I'm just doing some testing. I just wanted to give you a heads up.
And if you're reporting to Apple, what I have learned is that the feedback application that's installed for all the public betas and developer betas is the best way to file. It's actually, I think, preferred over filing a radar on the website. And of course, in there, the reason that's quite good is because it's an iOS app. It directs you to answer certain questions about your problem. And you can also do things like quite easily pick from your camera roll and videos and things like that. Now, one of the things I would suggest if you are reporting to Apple is to include what you might call an impact statement. So saying to Apple, how many devices are affected by this? You know, if you're a big school, you've got 1,200 devices, let's say. You could say, well, you know, we're a school of 1,200. Every single student is going to be impacted by this problem. Or I had one recently, that one I mentioned about the home screen layout and the offloaded applications. That only affects our testing situation. But the thing is, if that isn't fixed, then it calls into question the iPad's ability to be used in that testing situation. So that's an impact statement that has an impact beyond, well, maybe for us it's only 2 or 3 kids a year, but if the iPad is then no longer eligible to be used in an exam situation, that's a bigger problem that Apple's going to want to address. So things like that are, you know, worth quantifying how big of a problem actually is this for you personally. How many devices are affected? How many users? What kind of business processes are affected? And if you can kind of write that down and make that clear, that can definitely help increase the priority of your bug if it does turn out to be quite major.
Yeah, I had a bug in like, one of the first, I guess it was the first beta where I could not remove iMessage apps. Like, it just enabled them all and never would save if you disabled them. And like, I logged that through the feedback app and I got a personal like notification back with like somebody's signature on it saying, is this fixed now? Like, and it was, and I, you know, it was a nice interface. It really makes you think like, why is, I feel like it should be installed on maybe all devices at all time.
Yeah, I thought that the other day too. Yeah, why do we just have that all the time?
Yeah, I mean, because it's like, that's honestly the problem with filing radars is it can sometimes be cumbersome, so you kind of don't even want to deal with it. And in reality, every time something crashed, it almost would be nice to be like, hey, would you like to submit a bug about that? Or maybe that's overkill, but
well, what I know about the feedback app is that it's there during the beta process because Apple wants to collect as many bugs as possible, as fast as possible, and get them right in front of engineers as quickly as possible. And what I have heard through the grapevine is that the feedback application actually goes directly to the engineering teams. So, because you're sort of pre-qualified, if you like, because you're definitely running a beta version. So this report is actually coming from a user of the beta version, then that kind of, it's more than just like a suggestion or, you know, somebody complaining about something not working on a very old version or all the kinds of things that normally get logged into Radar. These are only reports coming from users of the current beta, and that's obviously the highest priority thing for Apple to get fixed. So my understanding is that you get a faster route to getting in front of an engineer if you use the feedback application rather than using the website. So maybe that's why we don't have it all year.
Good point. It's too much access.
Too much.
So that kind of wraps up where we are on testing iOS 11 betas. We had some more notes here on multitasking, but I know we're running late on time. We like to try to keep it under an hour, so we can hold that to the next show. I've got a lot more opinions on that because I have since upgraded to a 12.9-inch iPad and I have so many more opinions now about the multitasking because I feel like it's a better experience, but makes iOS 11 seem weirder in a lot of ways. So we'll save that for the next show, and hopefully we'll get another beta in between now and then.
Can I throw one other thing in?
Yeah.
Just before we finish, which is just to mention that when a new beta comes out, you're going to want to rerun your full test suite, yeah? Because regressions are real, right? A regression is where something was working and now it's not working again, and that can happen. So just don't think that because you got a yes in beta 1 that you don't have to test that feature again. You want to test it every single beta because sometimes, you know, in the course of fixing one thing, another thing can be broken that was previously working. So just don't forget about testing the whole thing every time you get a beta.
That's a great point. Don't forget to test again. Maybe that'll be the title, test again. Thanks everybody for listening today. We'll have links to everything we talked about in the show notes at outofschool.net. Thanks to our sponsor, Jamf. We love Jamf, especially this time of year. I am about to be cranked back up on Jamf here very shortly. We have teachers coming back in about 2 weeks. So, we'd love a review on iTunes.com we'd love a review in Apple Podcast at iTunes.com/out of school and share it with your friends if you like the show. And again, patronize Jamf if you're in the business for MDM solutions. I am Bradley Chambers, Bradley Chambers on Twitter and ChambersDaily.com on the web.
And I'm Fraser Spears on Twitter and Spears.org on the web.